Hello and welcome to High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast. I'm your host Spencer, and with me is he's a bit of a kooky old man. He just gave up his empire to his three weird sons, who we're not quite sure what their motives are. But
listen, they were fine this morning after the boar hunt. I don't know what's up with them now, you know? They just want their old man sitting in their tower shooting arrows at people. You're like, no, Grandpa, you can't do that. And I'm like, ah, man, I shouldn't have given up my throne. Or something. He didn't actually seem to have a throne. It wasn't that kind of movie. Anyways, my name is Joel.
Yeah, and we have special guests at the time. His name is Ben Sunday.
Hey.
Hello. So, why did you pick Ran? Because a while ago, I think it was over a year ago, you mentioned on Twitter you wanted this one.
Well, it's not my favorite Kurosawa, but it does resonate with me very strongly. The fact that it is a loose adaptation of King Lear appealed to me because Shakespeare is something I very much enjoyed studying in high school and college, and that is one of my favorite plays by him as well. Well, I mean, I could get into deeper specifics, but I do enjoy the drama, the costumes, the cinematography. It's very gripping portrayal of a man's disintegration from a hallowed and noble status to slightly better than an animal.
What is your, out of curiosity, what is your favorite
Kurosawa? Probably Ikaru.
That's going to be the big finale with, hopefully, Clint Worthington, who claimed that, I think he's the first person to claim a movie, actually. But, Ikaru.
And, we're going to do the musical version,
Ikaru the musical.
Ikaru exclamation point.
Oh, Ikaru's going to be remade by the producer of Carol. From a couple years ago. Yes.
Wait, is it really going to be a musical?
No. Musical is something completely different.
Okay.
That's for some reason Ikaru is in the water, and which is good. It's going to make people watch it. But it's kind of like, oh, that's weird. Two Ikaru things happening at once. But Kurosawa's son, Hayao Kurosawa, who's the head of the Kurosawa Company, a corporation, I forgot what it's called, is talking with the producer of Carol about the rights and all the legal mumbo-jumbo stuff right now. Yeah.
Hmm.
So
it would be a westernized adaptation?
I have no clue. All I know is just that there are talks of it, and the Kurosawa family is open to the idea of a remake of it. So, I don't know, we'll see in a couple of years.
You know a movie nobody's going to remake? Ran.
How do you know?
Well, I mean, technically, because it's already an adaptation of King Lear. It would be, I mean, that's not completely out of the question for them to remake something that was an adaptation of something else, because that's basically what happened with Yojimbo, anyway.
Yeah, and
so
Maltese Falcon was remade like 4 times in 10 years in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah, but who knows about the other ones? There's only one Maltese Falcon.
The Projection Booth podcast did
Maltesers.
A great episode on it. And the other three, not really worth watching.
Exactly. See?
I'd also say that Ran is a loose enough adaptation that it stands on its own more so than most other adaptations would.
It doesn't feel as strict to the original as Throne of Blood is to Macbeth, but there is still like very strong parallels to King Lear and what little I know of it.
I'm curious to know exactly how many of the story beats are the same as the play, because I know absolutely nothing about the play King Lear.
Well, the most significant difference is probably that in King Lear, instead of three sons, it's three daughters, Goneril, Regan, and Cordelia. And that, of course, changes the dynamic of the story a great deal, because with a king being defied by his daughters, in addition to defying the hierarchy, there's also a gender dynamic that's being violated as well. Whereas in Ran, you get some of that with Lady Kaede, because, of course, she is the wife of, first Taro, and then she hooks up with Jiro, and she's probably going against her prescribed gender role by orchestrating the downfall of this entire clan. But, of course, because it's Taro, Jiro going after Hidetora, that's actually more in line with what I'd say is the natural order of things. It's not violating a pre-described hierarchy as much, because we do expect old men to eventually fall before younger upstarts in the normal sequence of kingdoms rising and falling.
Yeah.
Yep, it's just like George H.W. and exactly. George W.
Yeah, before you know it, one of the Bush twins will be president.
No, no. Twins,
or is it just
yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah. You mentioned your favorite Kurosawa. How did you first hear about Kurosawa, if you can even pinpoint it exactly?
I mean, I don't know that I heard about him before seeing my first Kurosawa film, which was just Ikiru. I probably saw that on Turner Classic Movies at some point, and then that is what got me interested in Kurosawa's entire body of work.
I think that's a auspicious and a great way to start off that particular lifelong love, I assume. Wait, do you hate
Kurosawa? Oh, yeah, I hate him. I'm here to destroy him, you know.
Yeah.
Bring him down from the inside. Ikiru is a great film, but it probably does set the wrong expectations for the kind of director that Kurosawa is. Like, I mean, I didn't expect all these bloody samurai epics after seeing that.
Oh, yeah. Ikiru was definitely, like, one of the weird ones of the bunch for that era for him.
Very soft, pensive, meditative.
Yeah, Joel, you're
ultimately optimistic, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like my father. He's so offensive,
he
meditative.
Stars in it.
Always running around.
And your father's not in Ran or Ron because he had died already.
He died.
Kagemusha
yeah.
was the final Kurosawa film he appeared in.
Mm-hmm.
But,
I'm trying to think what role he could. I guess he could have been one of the old lords that was like, "You need to set up my daughter with your son." Or
yeah,
Shimura like
probably would have a role like that.
Point at the hip. Okay, he can do what he wants.
Yeah, Ran probably contrasts with Ikiru as much as any other Kurosawa film possibly could, because it's so dark and nihilistic.
Yeah. But. Okay, so the the plot is kind of, I can strip down the plot pretty simply, and we can just kind of go into specifics of what we thought of it and stuff.
Sure.
But so it starts out with this a boar hunt, and it's I did not write down character names, so I never do that. But it's Nakadai as Lord Ichimonji.
Yeah.
And he's with his two advisors, one from the Fujimoto family, and one from the Ayabe clan, and they go on a boar hunt, and they decide to set up camp for a little bit, and the old man, Pemonakadai, he falls asleep, has a dream, and realizes that he wants to just give his kingdom to his sons, and this causes a stir. His youngest son, Saburo, he speaks out, and his father's angry because of defiance, and the youngest son is banished, and the other two sons get to take over, and so then the old man is just trying to adjust to life, not as the ruler anymore, and well, his bodyguards are a little rowdy, and they don't respect his oldest son, Taro, and they kind of end up getting kicked out, Yeah. Oh, I forgot to mention, he has a fool, played by Peter, who, if you haven't seen Funeral Parade of Roses, you really should. It's a great, really bizarre, like, docudrama. And Peter, famously, he would cross-dress a lot in movies and in real life. They get kicked out of the first castle, they go to second castle, and the other son is not allowed to help his father, and so then there's a whole rigmarole thing of a trap set at the third castle. They go to third castle, the old man and his loyal warriors, and it's everyone's massacred except for him and his fool, and that's the first thing that really, really breaks him. Cut to hit.
Well, during the battle assault, Taro, the Lord's first son, gets killed. Quite, it could be played off as an accident because he's just suddenly shot in the back, and it's reported to the second brother Jiro that he was killed by accident. But obviously, it was done on purpose so that Jiro could become the head of this clan. And so they move back into the first castle. The Lord has appeared to have gone crazy. He's run off with the fool and the returned servant. That servant's name is Tango. He was also... What'd you say? His son was...
Yes, it's Saburo. The baby.
They were thrown out.
Exiled.
They were... Words. Exile, thank you. I'm smart. No, anyways. Tango does come back to serve his lord, and they are basically just wandering in the land, trying not to get caught, trying not to get killed. But Tango knows that Subaru is... wants his father back in power, or at least to live. So he eventually leaves the fool and the old lord to their own while he goes and gets the youngest son back. In the meantime, Jiro, who is now lord, gets confronted by Taro's wife, who is in this movie, she's the... the devil on the shoulder telling, oh, you don't have enough power, you should kill and all this stuff. And so when her husband is killed, she immediately moves on to Jiro and starts a relationship with him and is trying to convince him that he needs to kill anyone else who gets in the way. So when Subaru comes back for his father... At first, that is exactly the only thing he wants, is to get his father and to leave. But he is also backed up by two different armies that are there supposedly just to make sure everything goes okay. But it's obvious that they are planning to attack based on the show that they're putting on. Jiro does not back down from the confrontation, and there comes down to a big war, a big battle, where Jiro's army is very handily defeated. And at the meantime, the old lord is going mad, and he's basically gone mad. He runs off, and Subaru does... Subaru's he's the pizza place. What is the Saburo name of that character? Subaru, thank you. finds his father, and they're reunited very briefly in a happy moment until Saburo is shot by one of Jiro's men, and the old lord dies alongside with his son. So, basically at the end of this movie, all of these lords are... dead. Jiro is left with the castle in ruins and his army destroyed, and it's expected that he will commit seppuku. And it's just Shakespeare.
And it's also revealed that Lady Kaede had knowingly orchestrated the downfall of the clan because her father and brother had previously been killed by Hidetora, subsequent to her marriage to Taro.
Yeah, like, I wanted to go over all that stuff quickly because there's a whole lot of specifics and other things to talk about. So, like, the... Ben, you've seen this already, so, what's about this movie really sticks with you? Like, what's the thing that you always remember first when this comes to mind?
You know, I remember that, opening scene where Hidetora, Lord Ichimonji, takes those three arrows, as a symbolic representation of his three sons, and invites each of them to try to break three of them together. And the first two can't, Taro and Jiro. And the fact that they can't is meant to show that three brothers unified are unbreakable. And then the bundle of three arrows goes to Saburo, who can't break them at first, but then just holds them over his knee and shatters them that way in order to prove that he doesn't really understand metaphors. But at the same time, he is making a valid point that however strong this union of three brothers may appear, it is doomed to break down. He said three brothers have been raised in what I believe is described as an era of chaos and wrath or something along those lines, seeing their father behave treacherously, betray other leaders multiple times. And the idea that Hidetora abdicating now can somehow usher into this period of peace when his entire reign has been marked by war and bloodshed is ultimately a naive and foolish notion.
Yeah, I think you did mention it, but like, I love the irony. But it's not ironic at first, but the hint, but Nakadai, I always forget the character's name. I'm just calling him Nakadai. He, you know, he's talking about unity and working together, and that. But as you learn throughout the movie, oh, he's just the kind of a piece of shit that would do anything to keep his power.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a great undercutting of, like, this beautiful moment that if it wasn't cursed, like, other filmmakers could do this, but I feel like a lesser filmmaker would just completely mess up that whole thread of revealing this how broken of a person, and how much of a how full of shit he is, like from this opening moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think we default to describing this story as a tragedy, but if you look at it another way, this guy's getting exactly what he has coming to him.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah, but it's still a tragedy in that, like, even though his character is a bad person, is a warlord, you know, who got everything through death and destruction. It is still treated in, like, the father losing his children, one by, like, his kingdom, like, literally crumbling before him because of a few decisions that he made. You know, and he's just an old man who, like, was literally like, I just want to rest. I just, you know, I'm going to take this one thing in the tower. I'm going to have 30 men. And I just want, you know, I want my title, but in name only. Like, you're in charge of everything. I don't even want to bother anymore. Also, I have to have my fool. I can't just, like, walk around without a fool.
No TV, no podcasts. You got to have a fool.
Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier, but it's just bizarre to me seeing Peter not playing a woman or someone in drag. It took me a second to realize it was supposed to be him.
He's
supposed to be a man in this and not like a drag queen.
Right. I've never seen a character in any of the historical movies that we've watched for this show dressed the way he was. I felt that was kind of out of place, but, you know, at a certain point, I didn't really care anymore.
Yeah, Peter's costumes were, in particular, were the most colorful and the most extravagant. compared to like the very, very formal, like, wear that you'd see a lot of people in with like the very like exaggerated robes. And who was it? The costume designer won an Oscar this year, that year for this, Emmy Wada. She went on to do House of Flying Daggers and Hero. A lot of, there was some American movie that also showed up in here.
I think costuming does a lot of work in regards to Hidetora's characterization, because initially, when he first appears, he's a person of a very regal stature, and then he slowly disintegrates over the course of the story, and that's reflected in as much in his garb as in his performance. He becomes bedraggled and shrinks down, and he, by the very end, has lost all the nobility that he once held.
It's like the opposite of Ikaru, that where Ikaru, he goes from being this kind of... I haven't seen Ikaru in a while, but I remember him not being the best person, but he wasn't like a bad person initially in the beginning, but once he learned he has cancer, he decides to better himself and make an impact on the world, and he slowly becomes, as he's dying, he becomes a better person, where in this, it's the opposite, where as he's dying, he's not changing, he's not like trying to better himself or world around him.
Right, because he's not treating it as if he is dying in the old lord. He knows that he's old and that he can't really handle a lot of things. Like, everyone's so surprised that he gets exhausted after that boar hunt. Like, well, he's finally showing his age, but I still feel like he thinks he's going to be around for a long time. That's why he's, like, picking out his favorite tower and stuff like that. Yeah. It's not, like, to him... he wasn't really giving up anything. And like the way his sons were acting at that first meeting was like, oh, father, we can't really do anything without you. And it kind of turned out to be right, because the second he like is not meddling, you know, quote unquote, in their business, it all goes to shit.
Yes. In Don Richie Kurosawa book and the rant section, he basically writes that this movie is not very subtle, but like that that doesn't undermine it really. It's just like it's supposed to be this big like epic like of, you know, Shakespeare film, like Shakespeare adaptation. And like the number three shows up a lot. You have the three castles, the three arrows, the three suns, there's another
and he's watching my three sons at one point, isn't he?
Yeah. He has 30 bodyguards, so like the number three keeps showing up, and like three, and there are a lot of pivotal scenes. The people are, what's the word? The blocking is the people are in a triangle, and like there's the scene when he's getting kicked out of. The tower because his men are not respecting Taro, and it's the lady and the lord in front and in the foreground. It's the old man, and in front of old man is the mat where he would sit, but he doesn't sit there anymore, and they form this triangle, and like there are a lot of triangles formations and various scenes in this.
I thought he got kicked out of the tower because he killed a guy with an arrow. Too.
But also his men didn't respect his son.
I very much enjoyed that scene. It was like, oh, that just, you know, he was about to kill the fool, and all of a sudden it's like arrow in the back. Like, who could have done that? And there's just the old king leaning out the window. Like, you think I wasn't paying attention? Boom. You're the boar now.
Yeah, that's a pretty fast moment. And that's like kind of his last moment of him in control, really.
Yeah. Later on, when the third castle is being sieged, he tries to have another badass moment, whipping out his sword, and then it breaks in his hands when the moment of a very obvious Freudian symbolism.
Yeah. And, where's my stuff? The three sons. No, wait, I don't remember. The way that opens is kind of, I found creepy, where it's like this still image. Or maybe it's buffering, but it's like, it's pure like this like freeze frame, and then suddenly they start to move. And it's kind of weirdly unsettling.
Yeah, I thought that they were just holding incredibly still. Like, I don't know if they were on guard or looking for the boar or whatever was going on. That, but yeah, it was. It's interesting how they just like very subtly move. Subtly move, and then when it changes shots, then you get the idea that these are. It's not like a still shot. Like, these are different people just awaiting their time to move or whatever.
And, the music in the beginning is like it. I found it tense and scary. Like it was. I wrote and it's a mix of like Eastern and Western type music, and so this is very like you could use that music in a horror movie and it would be effective. Like, and it's just a great way of setting up like this is. Not gonna be a happy movie.
Well, you know that boar. Yeah. It's symbolism for him, yeah. I guess. Like, I don't know. Is that too subtle for that guy's book?
No,
he wrote?
Richie did bring up the whole thing where he brings up where he kills the boar. He's like, it's old and worn out, just like me. So we're not gonna eat it.
I mean, yeah, he says it. Yeah, like, he says it.
The screenplay is not subtle at all. But
and Nakadai looks at the camera and says, "Do you get it?"
Yeah, but you know it doesn't matter. It's still, you know, it's like expertly crafted. Like this, like every shot and every moment just feels very rehearsed and very specific. And I remember when we had Chris Funderburg from the Pink Smoke on, I think for Redbeard, he said he doesn't like late era Kurosawa after Redbeard because. It's like it's just too perfectly constructed, and he doesn't like how that it doesn't seem right compared to like his earlier stuff, which I kind of see that with like Kagamusha. I feel is a little too like just too like perfectly constructed almost, and where this had a little more meat on it too, where like it was in that range, but it still had a lot of enough other stuff where Kagamusha kind of felt big and empty to me, where this was, I didn't love it. It's not one of my favorites, but it's definitely, it is worth watching, but there's more to really chew on and think about compared to Kagamusha. And so like the overly rehearsedness of it kind of, I think works in its favor.
Ben, how do you feel about that late versus earlier?
I don't know that I'm really in a position to speak to the difference between late and early Kurosawa. I haven't really like paid attention.
You said you were hanging out.
But we were drunk the whole time, so who even remembers?
Oh, of course.
No, I haven't really approached him in a chronological order with mind for where certain films fall, the sequence of his filmography. It's more along the lines of just seeing if something seemed interesting to me and then watching that. Just taking it in and of itself.
That sounds like you don't have a Kurosawa podcast.
Yeah. Well, which ones have you seen?
Ran, Ikaru, Throne of Blood, Yojimbo, Sanjuro. Let's see. I don't really. I've seen Dreams.
So like all that.
Yes, it sounds like most of the stuff too. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, there is a definite. I see a difference between late and early Kurosawa.
Hmm.
But
definitely budgetary wise, like if you can compare like even
Yojimbo feels like a big production because of how much they get into the movie, like story-wise and character-wise and set pieces. But if you compare that budget to the budget of Ran, I'm sure you're going to see like a colossal difference. It's like, even though all that stuff is going on in Yojimbo, there still was probably like four or five actual big sets that they were using. And Ran, it seems like they had like a whole countryside that they were just going wherever. Like, and I just want to know like what the shooting schedule was, because everything was so freaking gorgeous. Oh, yeah. And green and beautiful, and the wind, like there were parts where the wind was blowing in the correct direction to give this shot this amazing thing. It's like, did they have big fans, or were they just like, hey, the wind's perfect, knock it out, go stand on that cliff?
Yeah, like, it was just like the cinematography is definitely for like one of my favorites so far with what we've covered on here. And the cinematography, costume, and Kurosawa himself were all nominated for Oscars and for this, and obviously, you know, only one of them won that for costume design, but it's still like this was like recognized like internationally, like, no, this is a huge return for Kurosawa, which Kagamusha I guess kind of counts as a comeback, but this is like, oh no, he really is back.
In regards to praising the cinematography, I also really appreciate how it's reflective of the dissolution of the kingdom, with the opening of the film being so vibrant and lush. And then once you get to the raid on the third castle, it becomes very dark and sooty and hellish, and hell itself is even evoked in dialogue. You can get a sense of like this transformation in the environment itself as this once proud king is brought to nothing.
Yeah, the even the ground towards the end is just like ash, and it's not like beautiful like plants and flowers. It's just like black, like this black earth that they're walking on at the end.
I'm covered with corpses.
And it's like this bloody, bloody bodies, ash, and like, you know, discarded weapons everywhere. It's just this really great not evolution, but I guess de-evolution from like the beauty, from beautiful to the ugly. And like the blackened earth actually reminds me of a couple of segments in Dreams. The one it's towards the end, it's the one with the demon.
Yeah, the one where the guy's like on the cliff, right, wandering around, the demon's like, normally I would eat you.
And like it's a metaphor for the people affected by the bomb, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. Also that end of the world one where I can't remember what the dream exactly is. It's like they're waiting for the next thing to happen,
and, like,
or something
the
that.
Chemicals are blowing in the wind. Yeah, and like,
yeah, that's what it is.
They're gonna die, and it's like, oh well, you can't do anything.
It seemed like the contrast was more whenever specifically the Lord Nakadai playing the Lord was breaking down mentally and stuff like that. Because when he's wandering around with a fool in that castle that at this point is like in ruins and has been probably for a long time, and he's like, where am I? Wait, no, I remember this place. I remember taking this place, you know, and it's just like destroyed stone and a staircase there, and you can hear everything echoing off the side, and it's like the fool's like, this is hell, or even like, I think he says like, this is the opposite of paradise. He doesn't say hell. And later there are parts where he's wandering in like otherwise a green lush part, but he happens to find the one place where there's like a hole in the ground, and he's like sleeping amongst the stones. Like, I don't even want to be in the grass anymore. Like, this should be my deathbed kind of thing. Like, for some reason, all the battle scenes are still glorious looking, even though, you know, there's blood and people getting shot and horses. Man, how many stuntmen got trampled by horses? I was really worried. Anyways, it's beautiful, and it's also, upsetting visually, too.
And Joel, I don't know if you got this vibe, but some of the, like, there are some visual things that remind me of Sanshiro Sugata, where, like, the you talked about the wind blowing in, like, the grassy plains, and that felt like a callback to Sanshiro Sugata Part 1, the duel at the end of that.
Yeah, oh, no, yeah, and I was trying to think about that, like, because the one in Part 2 stands out more to me because of the snow and the guy yelling, doing karate. But, yeah, that's, no, the duel at the end of Part 1. I mean, I think he likes those grassy plains for their showdowns. I mean, doesn't Sanjuro also have, like, a showdown in a grassy plain at the end?
Yeah, kinda. And I got, and when they reach the home of Lady Sua's brother, who's blinded, that reminded me of Sanjuro Sugata Part 2, where I kept thinking, oh, the blind guy is going to try to kill him.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't blame him for doing that, and maybe he would have if he had any means to, but he literally had a fire pit.
Like, visually, he looked like the crazy brother doing the karate. With, like, the crazy hair.
Yes.
Like that. And what's another one? I think
And that's how Nakadai looked at the end. He looked like the crazy brother.
Like the crazy brother. Ben, Sanjuro Sugata, it's a two-part propaganda movies about judo and judo's code for the Japanese way of life. They are worth watching.
Yeah, they're pretty good. They're not like top class Kurosawa stuff, but like I think they're pretty enjoyable.
They're his first movie, so it's, you know, it's not the best, but it's still interesting enough to watch.
Yeah, people are doing judo to each other. What else can you ask for? When was the last time somebody did judo to you? So focus on one particular part of this movie that I think is amazing, like 100%, like 5-star, give them all the awards. The whole battle sequence in the third castle, when his two sons' armies decide that they're just going to kill him and get it over with. Once everything starts going crazy and arrows are flying constantly, people are shooting constantly, all of his guards are being slaughtered. And they make the choice to, instead of hearing the battle sounds, just play a score over it while we see the violence occurring. Mm-hmm. You know, people, man, these concubines getting shot down. And there's that part where the two of them kill each other in like some sort of suicide pact. And then those other ones are just blown away around him. And I think that part is so amazing in its violence and like I can't even.
I really appreciated the weakness of it. It's sort of a battle without heroes. There's nobody that you're rooting for in that sequence. It's just people dying the worst ways possible, anonymously and, you know, pitilessly.
So I love the whole sequence. It starts out, because I feel like the sequence starts out kind of like, It's not bleak to begin with, but it's kind of like, oh, it's a big, epic, heroic battle, and then it kind of slowly turns into like, oh, actually, war is awful as it goes on.
Yeah, there's nothing heroic about that at that point where they're just like literally slaughtering anybody who comes along. There are parts of it that are silly and over the top when it comes to the violence too.
Like, number of arrows that fill individual bodies. Like, were they all aiming for exactly one guy?
I guess the guy who's like holding his arm, like, what do I do with this? And that's terrible. But it also it's kind of silly. What? And like just repeatedly shooting over and over again into the area where they know the Lord, you know, is. They don't know if he's alive or dead, to the point where like there's people walking in the building who get shot by their own
their own men, because it's like, no, we're just shooting and arrows and guns in there. Like, if you go in there, it's not our fault if you get shot, like, over and over. And he's just sitting there in the middle, like, this is hell, and I'm in it.
And, like, you know, like, literally his world, the world that he knows, and the world he knew and, you know, was the king of, created. Is burning down around him. And he's just kind of like, for most part, just frozen. And like this is like the first huge mental break of like, oh, my sons don't give a shit about me. And it's heartbreaking. It may be heartbreaking, yet at the same time, like I don't find his character forgivable for a thing that he did.
Mm-hmm.
But given that his children are trying to kill him, you at least feel, you know, basic sympathy on that level of like, man, even your kids are going after you. You know what I mean?
They learned it from watching him. Set a bad example. Yeah. That's what you get. But I also wonder if there's a degree of self-sabotage in regards to Hidetora's behavior and the decision that he makes at the very beginning that sets this whole thing off to abdicate and give each of his sons a different segment of his kingdom. Because before the battle at the Third Castle, he has that confrontation with Jiro's wife, Lady Sue, where he refers to the fact that he killed her father and blinded her brother, and he begs her to look upon him with hate, because he is, in that moment, feeling guilt, perhaps for the first time, for his actions. And knowing that that was lingering within him, I do wonder, maybe part of him thinks that he deserves this. Like, maybe part of him knew this was going to happen and decided to bring it on himself.
I didn't think of that.
Yeah.
So, how close is this to King Lear? You kind of hinted that earlier. Mm-hmm. But, like, what are the huge
differences? Yeah, I have some specific questions. Daughters,
which in the book, Darn Rotary brings that up.
Daughters, but instead of sons, is the primary difference between the two. Secondary to that, there is a second plot in King Lear involving two brothers, Edmund and Edgar, and that does not have an equivalent within the Rand story.
Is there a fool character? I assume there is, because
there is a fool, and like in Rand, he is the one individual who's able to speak freely to the king, because everything he says is cloaked in humor and presented as not a serious statement, even though it is, in fact, probably the truest thing being said to the king at any point in time.
Yeah, like the fool, is the, I won't say the smartest person in the room, but he's the most aware person in the room at all times.
Like, I would say that Saburo and the fool, Kiyomi, they are both equally intelligent, but Saburo's shortcoming is that he's not able to present his ideas tactfully or in a way that Hidetora may be receptive to. He speaks the truth. He says that this decision to abdicate and distribute the kingdom among the three sons is doomed to failure. He's totally right, but he says it in such a brazen and arrogant and thoughtless way that he's exiled instead of recognized for the truth he's telling.
Yeah,
he got what he deserved. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, and this, we mentioned the costumes evolution in this earlier, but I like that his face, that the Lord's face changes as it goes on.
Yeah, it becomes increasingly ghoulish.
Yeah, you get.
I mean, that's, he had a ghoulish face when I first saw him. I don't know what you guys are talking about.
The makeup gets heavier and heavier, and it's. It's yet another not subtle thing in this, where it's basically a gnome mask, and it's a reference to a specific gnome mask of the Dramatry book doesn't say a name, but it says like the type of the gnome character that it represents, and it's the old man who has seen life.
Mm-hmm.
And Joel, if you do watch this again, like his face just gets more and more like horrific and bizarre looking as it goes on.
I mean, I definitely noticed, but like Nakada is wearing some makeup to make him look, you know, older anyways, because I think he was in his 50s when this was being made, but he's being made to look like in his late 70s or whatever, based on the story.
Yeah,
at
the
least.
Character is early 70s, and Kurosawa was 73 when he made this.
And I read that his wife died during production, too?
The star of The Most Beautiful, what Kurosawa called his most personal film, because that's where he met the love of his life, his wife was the star of his second film, and yeah, she did die during production of Ran, and she, they took a day off to have a funeral.
Wow.
Yeah. And I don't really see any like direct parallels of like losing a spouse per se, but like the sadness of growing older and losing like control and you're like you in your inner in like this. Where am I going with this? But I feel like there is the same parallels of like Kurosawa getting older and his character is getting older.
Yeah, I don't know if I feel there's very much that like we could put directly from an auteur point into this. I feel like it's just his love for Shakespeare that made him want to do the movie altogether and make it his own production. Like, if you watch this back-to-back with Kagamusha. What was it? Kagamusha. It feels like he... I read that somewhere. It's like that was his trial run, and then Ran was the real thing. Like
Ran
feels like that
was he like, had the script of Ran done around the time he did Dare Suzala, and he just couldn't make Ran because at the time no one trusted him with like a big movie, and then Lucas and Coppola co-produced. Kagamusha, and because of that, actually, he had trouble gaining funding for this too. Like, it took a little while, but he eventually did find funding, kind of because, you know, he had the word of Coppola and Lucas.
I seem like another Russian co-production based on like some of the names I saw.
French co-production.
Oh, that's what. Never mind, not Russian. That's what I meant to say. French. Yeah.
But I want to talk about the lady, Kaida. How you say it?
Is there no equivalent to her in King?
Well,
Lear?
I feel like the equivalent to her would be one or two of the three daughters, Regan and Goneril, because they are they're not. Inheriting King Lear's kingdom in the same way that Taro, Jiro, and Sabaro would, because of course they're females, they're not in a position to rule as kings, so the power that they seize for themselves is a little more surreptitious and manipulative in nature, and that's the level that Lady Kaede is operating on as well. She is not in a position that's higher than that of Taro or Jiro, but she is nonetheless able to manipulate them and orchestrate things as she sees fit.
Yeah, because Jiro and Taro are pretty weak-willed.
Yeah.
Like, they're just wet blankets. It's like, you know, not wet blankets.
Kind of astonishingly, like, they really are just like, okay, I'll do what you say. Like,
they don't
even
put up a fight against, you know, this woman. They're just like, well, she's pretty and good to have sex, so I'll say yes.
Well, that's definitely Juro's motivation. He's like, my wife's practically a Buddhist monk. At least this lady wants to do things.
I don't think you ever see Jiro with his wife at any point.
Yeah, I don't believe so.
No, they're definitely not in A shot. She's always, I mean, based on the old lord knowing exactly where he thought she was going to be when he first got to the castle, it's like, of course she's going to be in her little worshiping place. But, she happens to be out on the grounds, but it's like that's where she spends all her time. He knew where to go
but,
look for
Lady Kaida, like her introduction really foreshadows who she, like the how powerful she is, because like she's there's a long line of the people at the castle, and she gets very upset and indignant about it, and so she just demands that she gets cut in line in front of everyone. And like when you first see her, you don't realize who she is, and so it's like, who is this very rude woman? And then you know you get then you you know learn that the lord massacred her family and caused her mom to kill herself, so she's not tortured to death, basically. And it's like, well, that's why she feels like she owns this place. She's like getting her revenge. Not getting her revenge, but like, you know, she's reclaiming her home that was stolen from her.
You know?
Yeah, it all comes to it. Like, it feels. I don't want to talk about gender politics like I know something. I just can't help but feel there's something very sexist about the manipulating woman being behind the scenes, whispering things into a man's ear and destroying things from the inside, you know. But, what are you going to do?
I would also say that, that I empathize with her probably more than any other character in the story, because she's the only person who's acting out of a sense of justice and righteousness, whereas the three brothers, well, I mean, Jiro and Taro more so than her, are just acting out of naked ambition, and Hidetora, as we've established already, is a terrible person whose entire kingdom has been accumulated through treachery rather than any sort of noble action. I was actually rooting for her plan, and I'm glad that she got to enjoy some small success before she too died at the end.
Yeah, and like she's just like I don't think you ever see her lovingly talk to her husband. She's always belittling him.
Oh yeah,
like when they're together.
He deserves it though.
yeah, like he's the weakest character in the whole movie. Like he doesn't really do anything unless, you know, provoked by his father or his wife or his brother. Like it's just he's just a blanket that just, you know, is going to be, that's a bad metaphor, but you know what I mean, like he just has no real drive to anything.
I have less sympathy for her as a character when she's like, after Jiro takes position as the head lord there. And she's like, no, you have to kill your wife. Like, you can't just divorce her. I want her head delivered to us. So much to the fact that when Jiro's main man goes out and he's like, no, I'm not going to do that. In fact, I'm going to play a little trick on you. I want Jiro to realize how foolish he's being. So I'm going to bring this fox head and be like, by the way, foxes are very deceiving. They could be anywhere, you know. And then at the end of the battle, it's like, since you didn't do it, the boss, it wasn't even the boss, it was the lady of the house told me to go do it, so here's her severed head. Like, that is just, it's one thing to hate that family, that's totally understandable, but this poor woman is also a
victim. Yeah, I would say that that's a plot point that I don't quite understand.
Like I said, I think that's one of the setups of like, oh, it's an evil woman. Like you can have sympathy for her, but we also want you to remember that she's an evil woman.
I feel like the Lord is a more evil man who, because of his actions, he kind of caused her to, you know, want this revenge.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. But I don't revenge against specifically that woman. Like, I guess if he wanted to hurt Jiro by doing that, But Jiro didn't seem to care. Jiro was like, okay, you're right. We'll kill her. You sexed me real good. I guess we'll kill her.
You might be able to argue that it's necessary in order for her to secure her hold over Jiro. Beyond that, though, I also think that her goal is not just to get at Jiro and Taro, or even Hidetora, but to see the destruction of this entire kingdom, and perhaps Lady Isu as the wife of Jiro is just collateral damage in that. Because if you're going to destroy the entire kingdom, that includes destroying the wife of the person who's currently ruling it as well.
Yeah. And her seduction scene is probably like one of the best moments in the whole film.
Yeah, it's great.
There's so much great stuff comes out of that. She wants to see her husband's armor, and he's like, "I am wearing." It's like, well, never mind. Too much to get into. I lost my thread.
Well, you just like the part where she's like gets alone with Jiro when he's in his head position and is like, "Oh yeah, we can be alone. By the way, I've got a knife."
Yeah, and she just literally like just dominates him, and I'm not sure if he initially lets it happen initially, and then it's like, "Oh fuck, she has a knife," or maybe.
I think he's a straight up coward, and he was not expecting that. And when he's confronted with it, he's like, "I don't know what to do." And it just happens to end up with I think she at some point mid the thing realizes that like the way to get him to do what I want, I could do this without actually hurting him. Like, I think if I seduce him, that he'll be so quote unquote grateful that. That's all the manipulation I'll actually have to do, and then I won't have to be killed myself or something like that.
Yeah, this is another not so moment where they cut away to something else, and a gun is fired, and you cut back to them right after they've had sex.
Yeah, guns fired, and some old men are laughing about it. It makes sense.
Like before they start, engage in the act, I think she's the one who kicks her husband's helmet away. Yeah, like this very distinct shot of like, I get what's happening. And
that means that they didn't have to wear a helmet, is that what you're saying?
She kicked her dead husband's helmet away before she has sex with his brother.
I see. Well, you know, Shakespeare's not exactly subtle, so
yeah, and there's this crazy moment where like she cuts his neck and then licks the blood.
Yeah, that's a...
I did not expect something like that to come out in this movie. Like that felt like in the 70s and 80s, like Japanese movies could be a little more erotic and like sexier, and that just felt like something you'd see in a Seijin Suzuki movie or like a pinky violence type thing. It's like this, and it was just kind of jarring, and it made me think of I can never say the name of the movie, but it's a Seijin Suzuki movie from 1980. The title starts with a Z. It's a German word. It's a musical piece for the viola, and there's a scene in it where this guy is hooking up with his friend's wife, and she licks his eye. Anyway, that just made me think of this, like, in mid-seduction, like, licking something that's weird.
Well, if we're leaning into him being influenced by the Japanese New Wave, then, I mean, that goes to mention Redbeard with the scene with the woman who's, you know, nude and thrashing around and them trying to force her onto the table to medicate her. That kind of leans into that, like, Kurosawa feeling a little bit of influence from the other filmmakers that are active there. I think that goes along with like as much blood, you know, play and spraying and everything else that's violent wise that's going on in the movie too. Like
Kurosawa had violence in his movies before, but I think because of the black and white and the general tone that he was going for, you don't really notice that much. And this one, you got people like squirting from their, you know, their wounds and stuff like that. And when Lady Kaede, is that his?
I'm not
Kaede, I think.
Kate?
Yeah.
Kaede? Yeah, when she finally gets it, you know, we don't actually see her get hit, but there's just a colossal blood spray on the back, wall, which is kind of glorious.
Yeah, like that's definitely like a Kenji Fukasaku like blood spray or like
yeah. It reminds me of Dario Argento's Tenebrae when the woman gets her arm cut off and paints a white wall.
Yeah. That's my favorite Argento movie. I like it more in Suspiria. And I always forget that kill happens. And every time I watch, I'm like, oh, fuck, that's so cool. Every time I see it.
So we're going to talk about Argento.
This is the Argento cast.
After Creepers, a.k.a. Phenoma, whatever. It's not worth getting into.
I don't know. It would be fun to just...
Opera is all right. That comes after Phenomena, doesn't it?
It's the first step in, like, he doesn't have it anymore.
Oh, and don't forget, Dario Argento's Dracula. Yeah, 3D.
Three Draculas, that's what it means, right?
Yeah, and he turns into a praying mantis.
Yep.
And he's got not only are there three Draculas, but all three Draculas have 3Ds, if you know what I mean.
Yep.
And all three of them have three daughters each. Nice,
voluptuous Draculas, just like Bram Stoker intended.
Yeah.
Wait, I was talking about the other word.
I know, the three daughters.
Yes, they also.
The third daughter of a third daughter, like a seventh son of a seventh son.
So, Ran's a good movie.
Like the only negatives about this, for me, is the first half I like because it's kind of, it has like a horror movie feel a bit, like with the music. And there's some like weird music stings when like a character will pop up, and like after the big battle, it kind of loses that tone, that weird kind of horror-ish tone a bit, and then it's kind of like, for me, if it dragged a little bit as the second half happened, but that's just me. This kind of felt like, oh, this is, like, you know, up into the battle is just great momentum, and then after that's like, oh, well, they're trying to rebuild up to another battle, but this kind of isn't the same. Like, it's something that, I don't know, it's just somehow that second half just doesn't sit right with me, and it's just not as good.
I almost feel like the funny thing is, you know, the movie being almost 3 hours long, I do feel like it goes by in a fairly nice clip the whole time. I feel like the resolution at the end almost happens too fast. Mm-hmm. Like everything else building up to it has been organized and storied out, and the characters have been developed. But by the time we get to the part where Saburo shows up with, you know, the armies that are assisting him, I feel like, okay, we're gonna rush to the end. This is, everybody, we're closing out here. Well, not to say that I didn't enjoy those parts, like, because I really do enjoy the Jiro's army getting slaughtered by the people in the forest with their guns.
Yeah.
And just the people on the cliffside doing the wave for their victory.
There's a moment that I have to bring up that kind of made me laugh, where I forgot the context exactly, but a couple people on horses find the fool and the lord is just like up on this hill, and they're like, where is he, and then he kind of appears above the hill, and the shot reminded me of Jesus Christ Superstar. Like, I don't know, it just felt like he had the long scraggly hair and you know, the very basic clothes. It's like, is this a call to, like, Jesus Christ Superstar? What is this? It's a weird moment to me. That's it. It's just That's like one thing that kind of took me out of it. But
yeah,
I like this more in Kagemusha.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, look, people listening, if you like Kagemusha, Martin Kessler, I know you like Kagemusha. Don't take so offensively. This, we just aren't too big on it.
Yeah, I'm not saying I would never see Kagemusha as a bad movie. I just feel like it is less substantial, less interesting than Ran is altogether.
Like,
in every possible way.
Well, like, Nakai's performance compared to Kagemusha is like, oh, he's more restrained here, but there's more going on with the character, where Kagemusha is kind of this, I don't know. Maybe I need to watch it again to appreciate it. But it felt like a similar type performance from Nakadai. But, well, like Kurosawa himself did say, like, Kagemusha was a warm-up for, you know, this. But, is there anything else you guys want to bring up with, like, music or editing or anything?
Yeah, Ben, is there anything you want to talk about?
Yeah, I don't know. Do you guys know anything about Buddhist theology? Because the Buddha is referenced a few times in this story, and I was wondering about the relevance of that. It ends, actually, with the blind man, Surumaru, dropping his picture of the Buddha in the dirt, and that... The choice to linger upon that, I wonder how that resonated with you guys.
I took that as a very literal take on them not believing, them like losing faith in religion, because there's a discussion, actually it shows up in the Don Retchie book somewhere, where it's the fool and someone else is talking about, the fool mentions like, where is the Buddha? And the other person, Tengo, says, enough, do not slander the Buddha. I'm not going to read all of it, but basically, like, Tengo is basically saying, like, well, the Buddha has abandoned us, because, you know, if it really was a Buddha or some god out there, he left and doesn't care about us anymore. And, like, the brother who's blinded, he mentions that he not converted to Buddhism, but he got real serious about it and in studying Buddhism. And his sister got real into studying Buddhism, Lady Sua. So, like, there's this little thread of it. And I think one of the sons... like, has, like, a shrine, and he does something with, does something for the shrine, I believe. But there are little hints of it here and there, but I just took it as, like, religion doesn't matter in this world anymore.
Yeah, I don't know anything about the theology or anything like that. I mean, it's directly because in the movie, right, his sister, Sue, or whatever her name is, is a devout Buddhist and has, in turn, because of her devotion, has forgiven Nakadai's character of all the atrocities that he committed against their family. And, like, that's one of the, like you were saying, Ben, that Nakadai is, like, showing this remorse, this sadness, that she is not angry with him, that she should be and hate him, but she doesn't feel that in her heart. As opposed to her brother, whose eyes were taken out as, you know, a substitute to death, and has been living in this shack in the forest. He is not a devout Buddhist. He says that he tried to forgive him, you know, through devotion to Buddha, but he just cannot, even for a single day, let go of his anger. So at the end, you know, when they're trying to make their escape, and Sui's, like, leading him along the way to
the castle that they're going to, and she has to, because the old woman went off to go get his flute and has to return, she hands him that scroll of the Buddha and says, don't worry, Buddha will protect you. Because he doesn't want to be alone anymore. He's like, please don't leave me by myself again. I can't take it. She's like, you won't be alone. The Buddha is here with you. I'm going to hand you this scroll, and he will protect you from this point. And so when she goes off, like, as a person watching the movie, of course, we're like, oh, she's dead. I still found it quite shocking when somebody shows up with her severed head, but I was like,
when they show up with her severed head the real time, it was very shocking, because the first time it's like, oh, I tricked you, and the second time, like, well, they're not going to actually do it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh no, she avoided it. That's fine. What the hell? I was like, that woman is just plain evil. Yeah. But I know, sympathy for her. But yeah, when he like lets go of the scroll at the end, when he almost falls off the cliff, it's literally like there is no one else to protect him. There is nobody else in the world. There is no Buddha. There is no sister. The old Lord isn't going to reappear. And he stands on that precipice. Is he going to continue and walk off of that cliff? Like, what else can he do?
Yeah.
And like, as that shot is like farther and farther away, it feels... I felt like a coldness, you know, an emptiness to the whole thing.
And do you feel the tone of that is consistent with Kurosawa's other work, or is that something of an outlier, the darkness that you see in that moment?
Yeah.
Depends on this movie, because something like...
His age when he made the movie. Because, like, his stuff in the 40s is, like, kind of uplifting, but kind of sad for the most part. And then, like, he made... You know, Seven Samurai, which is very uplifting, but there's a real sadness to it. And then, like, Bad Sleep Well is just really...
Yeah, at the end.
Bad
Sleep Well has a dour...
Like,
ending.
That one is just flat-out depressing.
I Live in Fear
is depressing, and it kind of depends on the movie and where he was in his life. And I think maybe him losing his wife contributed possibly to just, like, the... dourness of all this, because I feel like she's probably she's like in her 70s and 80s. So.
How does the play end?
Oh, I mean, it does end with everybody dying.
Okay, so I think it's just in line with the play and him, you know, one innocent character, like, it doesn't matter how innocent you are in this world, it's a world of violence and pain.
And,
yeah. Though I will say, King Lear does end with Edgar, one of the characters who doesn't have an equivalent in Ran. It's implied that he's going to take over the throne now. So there's a sense of restoration of order there. Whereas in Ran, we end on that note of death and chaos. And there's a sense that if there is any order to be found in this universe, it is just the order of death and chaos itself, that this cycle of a calamity is going to continue indefinitely.
Well, did you guys stay to the end of the credits? Because there's a scene at the end where a guy just like comes over to you and is like, hey, it's me, Edgar. Yeah. What's going on?
Sorry, I missed my bus. What'd I miss?
Yep.
Ran, I learned this from the book, Ran literally means chaos in Japanese.
Oh, wow.
And when used as a suffix to something, it means rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
So the title has a bit of a double meaning.
Sure. But, very appropriate to the story with the chaos we see, and also the sons rebelling against the father.
And this is, I know it's Kurosawa's last five or six movies all deal with old people at the end of their life. Like, sort of Ran, then Dreams, one segment. And directly deals, the last segment deals with, you know, being old in your life. Rhapsody in August, about being old in your life. Ikaru, that's not what his last means, but that deals with, you know, being old and at the end of your life. Like, this is a theme he kept going back to throughout the years. And, like, this to his last movie, Madadaya, are all about getting older and trying to figure out, like, just what you did your life and what are you going to do that you're close to death. So, like, this was, so death was, you know, clearly on Kurosawa's mind, because he made so many movies about it, and, like, his last decade of making movies was just about being old and trying to realize what to do now. But, is there any specific image or images that really stuck with you?
I mean, my favorite is definitely Saburo breaking those three arrows over his knee. he's a very charming character, and I actually wish that he was more of a factor in the story. Instead, once he's exiled, he really doesn't play a role until the very end when he arrives to rescue Hidetora and make amends with him before he dies.
Yeah,
he just disappears.
He's, like, really, like, exiled from the movie. It feels like over an hour. Definitely, like, at least over an hour you don't see him or hear from him. But for me, just, it's a generic thing to say, but just the burning castle is just gorgeous to look at. And just, you look at it as like, yeah, that was real. This isn't, like, CGI bullshit. Like, they really had to build that and really had to, you know, burn it down. Exactly. And just, you know, it's just a great example of, like, yeah, if you have an actual, like, you know, not to rant about CGI, it has its advantages, but, like, sometimes just having, like, a practical real thing there, it just looks so much better.
Now, I feel like CGI still isn't able to accurately capture fire. Whenever I see fire in a movie and it's CGI, it just looks fake to me.
Oh, yeah, it's always a real awkward thing with CGI and fire or water. Or like blood. But, like, yeah. Joel, anything for you that really stuck out? Like an image or something?
Yeah, I just keep going back to the old lord sitting in the burning tower as arrows are flying around him. Like, everything's flying around as he's just sitting there watching, you know, his world be destroyed by his own children.
This is a bad comparison, but he's like the dog in that meme where he's like, everything is fine.
Yeah, if he was sipping on some coffee or something, it would have been great.
But Ben, do you have a couple other 1985 movies that you like?
Right, yeah, we already mentioned Phenomena, a.k.a. Creepers. Wasn't that a 1985 movie?
I believe so.
Yeah, yes. All right, well, that's one I recommend. I mean, I know Suspiria is regarded as Argento's great masterpiece, and I won't pretend that Phenomena is on that level, but it is a lot of fun. It stars a young Jennifer Connelly as a boarding school student who incidentally and without explanation has the ability to talk to insects, which is an ability that comes in handy as she runs afoul of a local murderer.
She has a pet fly.
Which
I've never seen that in the movie, but you know,
and she befriends a chimp with a knife, who turns out to be a friend indeed. So I'd highly recommend that. Also, Nightmare on Elm Street 2, the weird one that doesn't.
The gay one.
The gay one, exactly. I mean, it's definitely an outlier in the franchise, but the homoerotic subtext that, in some cases, just plain text is a pretty interesting take on it.
It's the movie itself.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I saw that documentary, Never Sleep Again, and the director still asserts that he had no idea that there was any gay text in it at all. Whereas the screenwriter says, oh yeah, I meant for it to be there. What are you talking about?
Weird. Yeah, that's my favorite of the Freddy movies.
Really?
I've seen the first two and Freddy vs. Jason, which is a real shit show. But Freddy 2 is just so weird. I feel like it more than the first one, which is good, but the second one is just like, let's make this, like, weirdly homoerotic and, you know, what Freddy was the metaphor for being gay, which is problematic and kind of weird in its own right, but it's still like, huh, well, it's a main, like, you know, just, it happened, and I'm surprised it got made in the first place.
Yeah, I think an earnest attempt is being made to capture the internal turmoil of being gay in the 80s and not being able to express it, not even being able to, like, fully understand for yourself what's going on with you, which is, of course, represented in the main character having Freddy inside of himself as this mysterious force that emerges to wreak havoc upon his own life.
Yeah, and I believe it's from what I understand from fans, it's the only one where he kills an animal.
Oh, really?
There's a bird in that's sleeping.
Oh, yeah.
In the kitchen, and then like it explodes.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I.
Freddy doesn't kill that bird. That bird dies of natural explosion causes.
Kill the bird.
No, it just it gets so hot in that house, the bird explodes. That's the first thing that happens.
In Nightmare 2 is when his girlfriend, who looks like Molly, not Molly Ringwald, Blake Lively's older sister, the one who's in Twin Peaks, Garnet.
Robin Lively.
One who talks like her.
Wait, what? She was
Robin
in Twin
Lively,
Peaks?
Yeah, she's in season 2 of Twin Peaks. For maybe 5 episodes.
Oh, okay, that's why
she's
remember.
20 years older than Blake. There's a big age gap. But,
yeah, I know. Yeah, she was in Teen Witch. I know who you're talking about.
Sorry, we don't mean to fight in front of you. But
so tense.
Where the girlfriend
talk about this
later. The girlfriend
later.
Is reading from a diary, and the diary's like, and I watched the boy across the street undress, and then Jesse is like, "Give me that. I want to read that." And there's a famous scene where like he's going to his best friend's house, and his best friend's sleeping shirtless. He's like, "You could have had sex with a girlfriend, but you're gonna sleep over with me instead." He's like, "Yeah." Like, it, anyway, it's just. Filled some great moments like that, and the whole weird gym coach stuff in that too.
Oh yeah, they meet in like a leather bar or something, right?
Yeah, and there's this weird BDSM like torture thing with.
But it takes place in a gym shower with a wet towel.
Yeah, it's so crazy.
Yeah.
You guys, I'm not seeing the part here. I've seen this movie several times, and you know, it's just very exciting.
But, oh yeah, besides Freddy 2, you got, like, anything?
I mean, there's so many great movies from 1985. Commando with Schwarzenegger, Desperately Seeking Susan, Day of the Dead. Like, I could mention a lot of things, but if I'd single something out, I'd probably say Reanimator, right? Yeah. You guys have seen Reanimator, right?
I think you're on a horror fix here.
your icon is a zombie, so.
Yeah.
Of course, you're picking all the good ones.
Some
so
people like Reanimator. I don't like.
Really?
I
Hell
don't
yeah,
like
Reanimator.
Brian using the gore. It makes me want to vomit, which is the point, but I don't like things that make me want to vomit.
Okay.
Speaking of people injuring animals.
He does that in movies.
I'm just talking about the cat.
Yeah, doesn't go well for the cat.
Okay. So, Bandia, stuff to plug your coming up, or maybe book tours, or
No. We've got some film writing on 366 Weird Movies and the Proud Old Theater Film Notes blog, and also was on the podcast As If with Joel, the Minute by Minute podcast about Cool
Beetle. Aren't you in the Fifth Beetle of Next Picture Show?
No, I write into them sometimes.
They've read your, maybe like, I want to say 3 or 4 of your emails.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, to me, you're the Fifth Beetle of that show.
Well, I'm very flattered.
Joel, don't you send people into space or some shit?
I don't do that ever. I've never
sent
anything
after the Stone Cold incident.
No, she's just in the doghouse.
Are
that's
still
not
fighting
space.
Over the Stone Cold incident?
We're talking about this later off the air. I don't want to make anyone think anything weird's going on. So if you want to listen to me talk about science fiction and fantasy movies with my co-hosts, Sarah and Aaron, and occasionally Spencer, We got a podcast called Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space. And we're getting back to weekly right now. Coming out this Monday is an episode on the classic movie Ghostbusters, which we've been avoiding, but I figured let's have a little fun.
Why were you avoiding it?
And just because it's one of the big titles, and I didn't want to burn through all that. I mean, it's been 3 years. I guess we could burn through a couple if we want to. But it's just one we were like, if a guest wanted to talk about it or come on, we were saving it. But
the
we
thought we'd have fun.
Oh, man. Missed out.
Nope. Yep. And what did we do before that? We did some movie with
Tom Cruise.
In it.
Kill Future Reborn.
Oh yeah, Edge of Tomorrow. Yeah, there we go. Yeah, we talked about that recently. It's a really exciting, good sci-fi movie.
Yeah, I saw it in theater.
Memory.
I was like one of the few people saw it in theater. Yeah. It was fun.
Yeah, they didn't do a great job marketing it, but it is one of the most compelling sci-fi concepts in recent memory.
Yeah, when my friends told me about it, I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? And then when I showed up, I was like, well, I never saw a preview of this, but I wish I did. But, I lost my thought there.
And if you want to hear, we've got a whole library of episodes available, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, whatever you call it, Stitcher, all the usual places, including a couple that were from 1985, like Phenomena, the movie that you were talking about, Ben. We also covered Ewoks, A Battle for Endor, the movie with Wilford Brimley eating, I think he eats a couple of Ewoks, I don't know, I wasn't paying attention. And then, I was just looking at Lady Hawk, which I had never seen before. When we watched it, I was like, oh my gosh, there's been a piece missing from my life this whole time, and it turns out it was Lady Hawk. But episodes on all that stuff and more available in the usual
places. Halloween's coming up. Listen to my episode on that show of Texas Chainsaw, which is one of my favorite horror movies / favorite movies, period.
Death Laid
An
Egg.
Fun horror movie I talked about there. That's a great fun giallo. So for me, come up soon-ish, Martin, I was on Martin Kessler's podcast, talking about David and Lisa, the movie by Frank Perry and Eleanor Perry. They are the aunt and uncle of Katy Perry, the pop singer, in case you're wondering. But this is a 1960s teen drama romance about two kids with mental illness at a school for kids with mental illness. And it's just a very, very good character piece. And I don't think it's streaming anywhere. You have to get the Blu-ray or DVD, but it's definitely worth tracking down. And my blog, Jailhouse701, Japanese Cult Cinema. I'm midway through a series on Hideo Gosha called Hideo Gosha, The Line Between Sleaze and Prestige. Next part will be part 3 of the 1980s, which is a very, very tough time for him for a whole lot of reasons. And that's coming up, and I'm going to do an article coming up on the Japanese stars showing up in Westerns. Which, there's more than you think. And it's a kind of a weird subgenre I discovered. Like, Toshiro did a Western with Charles Bronson. So, yeah, there's some kooky stuff in there. And, that's it. Also, former guest, Lauren Wilford and Ryan Stevenson, their book on Isle of Dogs came out earlier this week. You should order it. It's great. It's, you know, if you like Lauren and Ryan, which you should, because they're really smart, and, you know, they've been on it 3 times, made us look real stupid, which was the point of bringing them on. You know, buy their book. They know, you know, it's well written, and it's full of this great insight into Isle of Dogs and Wes Anderson and, you know, Kurosawa and stuff. And, that's it.
All right. What's
next? Is with Martin Kessler. He picked Tampopo by Juzo Utami, which
again,
Looks like we're going to have to talk about another Itami movie. That's going to be boring.
Great. Yeah.
Yeah, his movies suck. They're hilarious and really emotionally moving at the same time.
They got jazz scores. Nobody likes jazz.
But that's coming up for October. The Halloween episode is on Coronico with special guest Wendy Mays. And there might be another Halloween episode, possibly, but I haven't. I'm still working on the details if I'm going to do that or not. So, yeah, so look out for those. Ben, thank you for your time.
Oh, yeah, happy to be here.
Yeah, where can people find you if they want to find you?
My Twitter handle is @herradiation, so go ahead and look me up there.
All right. So, yeah, we'll see you guys next time. We're talking Tompopo. #ThugLife. The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. The show's Twitter is @highandlowpod. The show can be found on Facebook under the title of High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast. The show is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Podbean. We are no longer on Podiant. Thank you for listening. Cause it's something like a phenomenon. I hit you with a beam of light. Like phenomenon.